This Dharma talk was given to the Clearway Zen Sangha by Lotus Vu. This talk is made available free of charge. More information about Clearway Zen can be found at www.clearwayzen.ca.
When I was a child, I heard one of the first sutras that I read, the composers of these sort of four short lines of poem in each stanza. Translated from Pali, called the Dhammapada. Short teachings of Buddha. I really like these teachings because it's kind of like short sound bites that you can that you can quickly read and digest for a kid with very limited attention span. It's good. One of the Dhammapada's teaching, which relates to the mind, forming the bulk of all of Zen practice, is that the mind precedes all mental states. The mind is their chief. They are the mind, they are all mind rocks. If an impure mind, a person speaks or acts, suffering follows. Him like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. So with an impure mind, a person speaks or acts. Suffering follows him like the wheel that follows the foot of an ox. So you imagine this is very, you picture in your mind an ox drawing apart. And that is what the Buddha calls the impure mind. The cart is loaded with suffering. So, in the second stanza, it says, the mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are mind rot. With a pure mind, a person speaks or acts. Happiness follows him like his never departing shadow. So I really like this kind of description. I really like this description. First description is the ox drawing a cart. And suffering follows the ox like a cart that's he's drawing. So he can never escape the cart, can he? It's kind of tied to him. He's drawing it. And the second part of this teaching speaks of, with a pure mind, a person speaks or acts. Happiness follows him or him like his never departing shadow. So your shadow follows you everywhere, except it carries no weight, right? When was the last time you carried your shadow? So I really like this imagery that the Buddha conjures. Would you rather be the ox? Would you rather have the shadow? And so these stanza in about Dhammapada in this part, they come in here. You can see the first part of the teaching. They kind of get repeated in the second part, almost the exact same thing. The only difference is your mind and impure mind. And for a kid to remember, this is super easy. I guess this is why my teacher should have given this book first. Super easy to memorize. And I like the next part of Pear that the Buddha taught. He abused me, he struck me, he empowered me, he robbed me. Those who harbor such thought do not still their hatred. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. Those who do not harbor such thoughts still their hatred. So, what kind of image do you conjure with such thoughts? the victim, I tell you, right? A couple days ago, I couldn't do anything, so I just sit and listen to this podcast of a woman who was in the Secret Service, and she was there at the Twin Tower base of the Twin Tower when 9/11 happened. Her office was there. So when the first plane hits the tower, she ran out. And, you know, everybody was running out hours. And she was triaging the people, trying to help them coming out, the people who ran out. And then when the second plane hits the tower and everything started burning, she said she never thought that the tower would fall. But when it started falling, she realized it's too late to run. So she cowered into a corner and sat there and sort of saw her life flash before her eyes. I think she was in her late 20s or something like that. And she started to train. She recounted her experience that after what happened, she survived, luckily survived. And it was mandatory for the Secret Service to, you know, from that office, to have everybody go and do group therapy 2 days after the incident happened. Now we know that's actually really bad. Back then, all of you didn't know. That was good. No. But now we know, through research, that's really bad because the traumatization just happened. You're basically reliving it. So she went to group therapy, and in the group, about 10, 12 people, everybody was going around recounting their stories and how traumatized they were and telling their stories, where they were and what they were thinking at the time. She said by the time it got to her, she thought, I'm kind of full of traumatized story. I don't need to add more of this of mine onto this. So she just kind of whisked through hers kind of superficially. And she decided her healing was not going to be talk therapy, but was going to be action. So she volunteered in the cleanup crew to help pull survivors or people still trapped on the rubble or pulled out bodies in the 9/11 tower crash. And she said that healed her trauma. It made a big difference. Because she was no longer dwelling on what happened to me, but looking at what can I do now for other people. So in that experience, she said, I have overcome what happened by the force of service to others. When we have thoughts, and we harbor them, and we hold on to them, and we feed them, and we add more onto them. It's called a narrative, a story. And there's nothing wrong in, you know, for people who are very traumatized to be able to speak their voice, to have some narrative, to be able to speak out and to let their body and mind release the trauma that's holding in their body. Because I've been trained as a trauma therapist. So I understand that it's really important to do that, to be able to validate the person's experience. However, if that story continues to go on, and that story is not let go, and that tension and all that emotion in the body and mind that was tightly held after the fall, it's not let go by some means, whether like this woman, she let it go by helping others. It was not let go by some means that an identity is built. And when that identity is held onto, it's fed, suffering ensues. How do I know this? Because I was born after the Vietnam War. I see the ravages of the Vietnam War when I was a child. I see how the country was transformed, the lives of people, and the suffering that ensues during the U.S. trade embargo that I lived there. I saw the community shell-shocked from all of that. And then the anger of the Communist Party saying, oh, you traitors, throwing all the previous, you know, opposition into work camps. Well, they call it work camps, but it's basically heavy labor camps, which many people died there. Luckily, my uncle came out of it alive after 10 years. So, in order, because they're angry of what happened, they seek revenge. But what they're not seeing is when they're seeking the revenge, they're destroying their own society. Those people that they throw in the work camps, that they try to, I guess they call it re-education, but it's really brainwash. And when they do that, they're destroying the best members of society, the intellectuals. My uncle was a professor at the university and got recruited to psychological service. It's not the CIA, it's just academic. But they're destroying a whole generation of people who could have built that country, Vietnam, after the war, with reconciliation. But they didn't. So I spoke to a lawyer who experienced 10 years of work that hard labor camp. Before he came to Canada and settled in Quebec and eventually came to Toronto, I met him to the Toastmasters. He was an incredibly generous person. He spoke fluent English and French, and very well educated. He said he was teaching, you know, army law. He had a rank in the army, but he was really just a professor. When the war happened, and they thought of him as the dangerous ones, you know, planting seeds in people's minds. So he got heavy labor camps for 10 years, like my uncle. I don't know, something they have against professors. Anyway, and I asked him, you know, when I was growing up in Toronto, recounting the horrible, listening to a lot of these horrible stories that happened to people in my community during the war and after the war, the exile community in Toronto and Canada are refugees who are escaping the persecution after the war. My father was one of them. And so I asked him, I listened to a lot of stories. There was a lot of anger going on. But this one lawyer, it was different for him. I said, what happened? How come you bear no ill will with these people? And he said, well, they just must have misunderstood us. He's like, they just misunderstood us, just like we misunderstood them. And he said, I don't bear any ill will towards them because it is the past. It is gone. And, you know, I'm here in Canada. I have an opportunity for a newer life, and that's all that matters. And, you know, I don't want that kind of thing to happen anymore because they misunderstood us and we misunderstood them. So that's why I volunteer and go to Toastmaster to help people build effective communication. So that was a very inspiring story. Why? Because this person has turned their torture, their 10 years of persecution in the labor work camp into a force for changing others around him. And it was, being around him was very nice. He seemed very light-headed. He's very light. He's easygoing. He's very light. He's always inspiring. I call him Dupo, Uncle Vaughn. And he didn't have one thing that I've noticed with a lot of people in my community, which is the victim identity. I remember when my father helped secure some visas for performers to come out to Canada in the early 2000s to perform cultural things, there was a whole bunch of people protesting outside the door of the venue. Go home, go home, communists! And I thought, did you let him speak? No, they don't get the right to speak. And I thought, wait a minute. Aren't you supposed to stand for freedom and democracy? What's going on? And as a teenager and a young, you know, at the time I was in my early 20s, I thought, I'm very confused. I thought it's the communists who, you know, the communist enemies who are, or the system that are stopping you from free speech. Why are you guys stopping them from free speech? And so I saw that with the victim mentality, with the people harboring these thoughts that you did this to me, I did that, you know, you did that to me, you abused me, you hurt me, you did all those horrible things to me, I'm getting back to you. we all turn into what? Perpetrators. And that was then was when I ended my political career in the Vietnamese community. It just didn't work. Before that, I followed my family to, you know, do hunger strikes for Amnesty International and, you know, do all these protests to change things. And what I find is that we have the same energy. That was the communist factory that I saw when we grew up in Vietnam. What was that energy? Communism was all built on one thing. You exploited us. You victimized us. We stand up. Right? The victim mentality. And what did it do? The ideology of communism in Vietnam, after the war, it killed millions of people. 1 million Vietnamese people died in the South China Sea from trying to escape the persecution. 1 million people just trying to escape died in the South China Sea. Countless millions of people were persecuted and died in labor camps. And well, if you look into history of the Soviet Union, the Gulag and Mao Zedong's Long March, Mao Zedong's history, it's very telling what happened. They've killed their own, more of their own people than any foreign invaders. And what of all that came from? It came from the victim mentality. And for the Buddha, it starts with us. We have a responsibility to not be holding on to our trauma and living our trauma and healing from our trauma, not harbor that victim mentality. Because in that way, it's like, as he The Buddha compares, it's like swallowing poison, expecting the other person to die. Of course, you might spit it on them, hopefully it hits, which for Mao Zedong hit a lot of people. But that's essentially the same thing. So when I grew up in the Vietnamese community, there was a lot of anger. Because there was a lot of trauma. There was a lot of sadness. There was a lot of story. And I grew up listening. I was a good listener to all these stories. And I guess most people weren't a good listener, so people just find me and tell me all their stories. I don't know, why would you tell kids this story? I was like 15 years old, and all these people were telling me all these stories about, you know, their their labor camps experience, the war experience, the concentration camp experience. But I was born after the war, so I was immensely curious to what had transpired before I was born that had an effect on my family and myself. And so I listened to all these stories. What I found is that those who were able to let go of their story, to let go of the anger and the resentment, to let go of the victim's identity, moved on with their lives, have fruitful lives and became really happy, and was able to adapt and settle well in Canada. I've been in Canada for almost 40 years now. So I can attest, you know, seeing all the members of my community change and grow. And those who did prosper were those who carried the victim mentality. Those who did prosper, settled, integrated into Canadian society, and moved on with their life. With all that, rolled up their sleeves and did something about it. They volunteered. They went out and, you know, volunteered for the cause of helping people, homeless people, food banks, something like Mr. Vong, Uncle Vong, volunteers for Toastmasters. He thought that communication led to this, all this thing. I'm going to volunteer for Toastmasters to help everybody communicate properly. So, for people who haven't healed, continue to carry their victim mentality, and ultimately harm themselves and others, how do I know that? Because I lived with that person for over 20 years. It was my mom. She went through a lot of traumatic things. She never healed from it. And then came to Canada. My parents divorced shortly after she came. Harbored a lot of anger and resentment, couldn't accept the situation. Until my father died for 20 years. I saw her wallow in anger. It consumed her and everybody else around her, which was us, children. And so when my father passed away, she was very angry. And she came. She said, why do you go to his funeral? You betrayed me. And I said, he's my dad. And she says, why do you do that? And I looked at her and I said, you can put the bag of rocks you've been carrying around 20 years now. He's dead. And when I talked to my father, I said, you guys had a really messy divorce. How come, mom's very angry at me? And he said, really? I don't really think about it at all. I pretty much moved on with my life. And he said, I don't know why she keeps thinking about it. It's like, come on, it's 20 years ago. So, whatever you harbor, the thoughts that you feed, the memory that you replay in your mind of the past, the identity that you identify with the stories you create. And you can weave so many different narratives about an event, because listening to people coming from the Vietnam War with so many different narratives, I can tell you, the same event might be happening, but there's so many different narratives on it, right? So it depends on the perception of the person. So when we're attached to those things, and we live in the past, we probably don't even know we're living in the past, because our behavior is unconscious, and we're just acting out what's going on in the past. And so what I find is that when we're acting out what's going on in the past, the patterns that we acquired from our trauma was never healed. The closing of our hearts, the hardening of our minds, when we focus on that, and we hold on to that, and we can't identify that to let it go, to transform us, to live in the present moment, we do ourselves first the greatest disservice. By being like the ox, drawing the cart behind it full of suffering. Also, we harm those around us. The people we love and care about most. Honey, I love you so much. Here's a bunch of suffering. We unconsciously do that. And we don't even know. But the result is the same. The result is the same. Those people, the effects are the same. Whether you intentionally are or unintentionally to do that. You know, it sucks practicing Zen. Because when you start practicing Zen and you meditate, you start looking at yourself, you go, I'm really a big asshole. Look at my patterns. I can't believe it. I got all these patterns. Right? And I call that an enlightenment moment. It's a good thing that you realize that you have all these patterns that you perpetuate to harm yourself and other people. And in society, we all do that to a certain extent. It's a matter of degree. And so, when we do that, we wake up to the reality of the present and realize that we're perpetuating the thoughts, the feelings, the memories of the past, the identities that we built with it. We create our own suffering and give the gift of suffering to those around us. Until they can't stand it anymore and they're just like, I'm out of here. And yes, that's what happened. Kids moved out of the house. I'm out of here. Are you going to come back on the weekends? No. Unfortunately, with this current generation young men and women, they're stuck in their mom's hot basement for a while. Right? So we have a responsibility to ourselves, to our loved ones, to the people who occupy the space around us. Be awake to our own function. Really, our own thoughts, our own patterns of behaviors, and cultivate compassion, generosity, the opposite of all the suffering. Another sign that was given to me by a senior monk when I visited him in Edmonton in 89, and he did all these beautiful Dhammapala quotes into his walls, hanging signs and, you know, posters. And he had one hanging on his wall that said, the thought manifests as the words. The words manifest as speech. Speech manifests as the deed, the action. The deeds get repeated, becomes habit. Habits ingrained long enough becomes character. So watch the thought and its way with care. Let it spring from love, born of respect for all beings. I love that quote. I still carry it since then, from 1989. I know it's pretty old looking anything. That was one of my favorite Dhammapada quotes because it gives us empowerment. We're capable of doing something about it. We don't have to be the victim. And matter of fact, I experienced a lot of trauma in the past, which many of you have already experienced. It's not great growing up in a traumatized, you know, community, Vietnamese community to begin with, a traumatized mom and family and all that stuff. And so for me, one of the first steps in healing trauma, in ending our suffering, is to not believe in that thought that arrives. Like the Buddha said, he hit me, he hurt me, he abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. The Buddha says, those who harbor those thoughts create their own suffering. And so, the first step in healing for the Zen practice is to let them go. I'm not saying they won't arrive. You harbor them long enough, they come on like weed. Like, so they're mind weed, right? So every time they come on, what do? We apply our Zen practice. We apply our experience of mindfulness, or I call it do nothingness. Just look at it and go, bye. Okay? No judgment. It's okay. That thought is there. It's like weed. It's like, you're not going to criticize weed for growing. So you will not criticize yourself for feeling a certain way or having a certain thought. But if it carries out to become action, and if it does harm to another, then we need to learn to refrain from doing that. Stop it at the level thought, and don't let it build out at the level speech and then action. Right? But we do not pick it up. We do not harbor it. Like clouds rolling by, we say, hi. Nice visit. And that is the way the Buddha taught on the art of healing. To harbor good thoughts, like one that stems from love and compassion. Our loving kindness meditation, how does it start? May you be happy. May you be healthy. After you do the scribble in my loving kindness meditation, at first you don't believe it, and then after you keep doing it, it felt really good. Generate a lot of good hormones and a lot of good feelings. Why? Because those thoughts are of generosity. Those thoughts are of kindness and compassion. And there's tons of studies. Now, positive psychology has been around for a while now. It was new when I first came upon it. But there's tons of study that shows that kindness and compassionate acts actually generates a lot of happiness internally for the person doing it. So one person told me on the campus of New York University, he was trying to write a software to help people give more. Computer science student. The good project that he was thinking of with his friend. And he said to me, isn't generosity the most selfish act? Because in generating generosity, in doing generosity, you feel so good. So you just keep repeating it, then you'll feel good. And I said, well, probably, but I don't think it's taken that way. This is must be the ultimate selfish act. You're making yourself feel good by doing things for other people. I was like, okay, that's good. That's what I figured it out. In practice, it's important to observe our body and mind. It's important to accept what arises. And it's important to not identify with the thoughts, feelings, and emotions and sensations that arise. Why? Because when you turn anything into identity, that's all you see. And And so when you practice, you will have first-hand experience of this. When things are seen through a certain lens, the world is very distorted.
This podcast is created by members of the Clear Way Zen Sangha. If you enjoyed the talk and wish to show support, donation information can be found on our website, www.clearwayzen.ca. Thank you for listening.